Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on efforts to transform Afghanistan. In this hour, we'll hear from Ambassador Hamdullah Mohib. He's Ambassador of Afghanistan to the United States. He'll be in conversation with Carl Eikenberry, former U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan. Carl Eikenberry is currently Director of the U.S.-Asia Security Initiative at Stanford University. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Carl Eikenberry.
Well, I feel very privileged and honored to be up here with Ambassador Mohib, an old friend, and we're going to have a wonderful evening together. I know I see many friends out there from the World Affairs Council, from the Asia Foundation, most importantly, see many friends of Afghanistan and the United States that are out here, so it's good to see all of you this evening. What I thought I'd do, if it's okay with you, Ambassador, is maybe give an opportunity for you to talk as long as you'd want to about the situation in Afghanistan. As a prelude, I was talking to an Afghan friend not long ago, and he had said, if you ask an Afghan today, how's the situation, and you say you only have one word to give the situation, they'll say good. If you say they have two words to use to describe the situation, they'll say not good. And so we go back to 2014, and 2014 was a real milestone year for Afghanistan, for the United States, for the international community. That was the year that David Arnold talked about, in which Afghanistan went through a difficult election, but ultimately a remarkable event. First time in Afghanistan's history that you had a democratic transition of power. And that occurred in 2014. That was also the year that the agreement was based upon our agreements that U.S. military forces, international military forces, would end combat operations. And as they ended combat operations, more combat operations than with the Afghan army and the police now fully in the lead. At the same time, a lot of money that was being spent in Afghanistan by those military forces, many in productive ways, development assistance started to come down. But now as we look back, it seemed almost like a perfect storm. You have these three shocks that occur. Then you have a political shock as a national unity government is trying to come together. You have a security shock as the Afghan army and police in 2015 now are trying to move forward without this robust support that they had traditionally enjoyed from U.S. and NATO forces. Third, you had the economic shock. So dealing with these three shocks, here we are in 2016. I'd like to give you, Ambassador, just some time to talk with us about how do you see that transition that your country's been through now over the last 18 months, and can you give an assessment of how Afghanistan is in the summer of 2016?
Absolutely. First of all, this is my first time in San Francisco, so it's great to be here and great to see so many. Just in the few minutes that I was here, I saw some friends of Afghanistan, made me feel really happy, and we keep saying that Afghanistan has a lot of friends in the United States. They're not just in D.C. It's wonderful to see so many of you here. It's an honor to be in front of you. And thanks to the World Affairs Council and the Asia. Arnold, thank you for co-hosting this event. I see him in D.C. and it's wonderful to see you here too. Yeah. situation, I think you perfectly described what we were going through. It was a perfect storm. I think what it looked like, looking at it from 18 months later, it felt like the plug on the bathtub had been emptied, and the bathtub was completely emptying. We hit rock bottom. It was a year of survival. 2014 was a year where everyone was betting on Afghanistan's failure. Not, I wouldn't say everyone, but all those that were following the situation in Afghanistan felt that since we're going to be hitting all these three, and they're predicting that with the military withdrawal, that we would not be able to, our military would not be able to hold ground, that we would soon lose ground to the Taliban. And that didn't happen. Now, despite their best efforts, they didn't meet their strategic objectives. They didn't capture and hold ground last year. Our security forces did really well on that front. But we did get we had a lot of upsets, and it was a very difficult year militarily. On the economy front too, because the international assistance with the military, there was so much assistance associated with that. They were working in provinces as provincial reconstruction teams, so they hired many Afghans. In addition to that, there were contractors that were feeding to the economy through this military funding. With their withdrawal, we lost between an estimated 200 to 400,000 jobs. Afghans lost their, and the effect of that on the economy itself was huge. To top that up, this was our first political transition. And Ambassador, I have to say that for any democracy to be able to really survive its test of whether a democracy would work, it would have to pass the test of a transition when the power is passed from one elected president to another, because that's when the real test begins on how the institutions in that government align itself. Or align its loyalties to the institution, which is the presidency, not the person who was the president with that. And I think we had trouble in the beginning where there were difficulties for many of the Afghan government institutions to do that, to make that adjustment, to realign its loyalties to the new president, or at least to the presidency. Key examples were some of the security institutions, because most of them were built around President Karzai. When these were built, one president in time. They were used to dealing with him. They were used to reporting to him. They were used to his policies. And a new government, a new administration comes into being, and the policies change. Some they may agree to, some they may not, but they had a feeling of where they should be taking their instructions from. And also, it was a big test because, we feel we're proud to have made, gotten out of it, is if the transition had not happened, there was a lot of discussion that President Karzai may remain and we may extend that power. That was the fear for many Afghans. If that had happened, we would become like many other so-called republics who are in effect are republics and do hold elections, but it remains the same leader over, time and again, and moves from a benevolent dictator to a dictator, from a president to a benevolent dictator to a dictator. And that could have happened to Afghanistan, having had no history of political transitions like this. It was a time of fear, but it was also a time for the new government to be able to put itself forward and deal with those issues. And despite all the negativities, prove that Afghanistan has come a long way, and to show to those who invested in Afghanistan, and thanks to the international community for their heavy investment in building institutions in Afghanistan, to show that work had paid off, because we passed the toughest test of our time. Looking back, we are in a much better place today than we were 18 months ago. Challenges are not over. There will continue to be more challenges as we go. But the government is able to deal with them more effectively. This year, despite the fact that the Taliban have increased their efforts by an estimated 75%, they're not able to have even the successes they were able to claim last year. Yeah, they're on defeat. The Afghan military is winning. Last year, because it was our first year, we had trouble coordinating amongst each other. We were not used to. There was a lot of support provided to us, air support, coordinating support. It was the first year we didn't have any of that. We also didn't have intelligence as what we were used to. The ISR capabilities were gone with the international security forces. In many ways, we didn't have an upper hand. The Afghan security forces, if we could see the Taliban, the enemy, they could see us. And they had the upper hand because we were in uniform and they were not. So they could identify us and it was difficult for us to separate. This year, we're luckily have more capabilities, and at the same time, our military is able to coordinate better amongst the different agencies in the government.
You know, as the the Afghan National Security Forces, the Army and Police, they make this difficult transition from having enjoyed a large amount of U.S. Air support and direct combat support, intelligence support, and less. Now I recall conversations with some of your national security leaders, Army leaders, and they talked about this transition period a few years before it was to occur. And they said, you know, what needs to happen is that you, the United States, you're going to have to let go to an extent. We're going to have to let go. We like that support, but we know that it can't be sustained. And so it's as if you're going to have to let this Afghan army go out and occasionally get a bloody nose, but never let them get a broken nose. And I thought that was a pretty good metaphor, but it has been difficult for the Afghan National Security Forces. And of course, I think most of in this audience are aware that not too many months ago, you did have a setback in the northern province of, in Kunduz when you lost the provincial capital for a period of time. Do you worry about that? Were there any lessons learned from that that the administration and your national security forces have been able to internalize now, where you think that as a result of getting that bloody nose, so to speak, you're emerging from this stronger?
It was more than a bloody nose. It was a major setback for us. But like you said, it had lessons attached to it. And as we evaluated what happened in Kunduz, the different security agencies were called to do their assessment on why this happened. And they all came back and they felt they all did their job. And that's where I think the big surprise or the impact of this international forces was, because the intelligence agency said that they had filed a report. They knew that there was going to be a threat, and they filed that report. What happened after that is something they were used to having the coordination done by the ISAF forces. So they would file a report. It would be coordinated between MOD, our Ministry of Defense, and Ministry of Interior, and who takes action on what's being done there, and highlight what the threats are, and evaluate the threats too, because you get a big threat report on all the different threats, which ones are more eminent than others. And we discovered that despite the fact that all the security institutions had done their job, the bit that was missing was the coordination and the taking the lead by the Afghan forces. So a lesson learned from that was that, you know, it's not enough to just report the threat, it's to highlight and analyze which threats are ones that we need to take action, and what actions are required so that when it comes to the National Security Council, that we take action and that we do not allow this to happen again, which increased our cooperation. This was a difficult lesson, but it was a lesson learned. And so, as our president puts it, last year, our military was 12 years old. This year, our military is 20 years old. It made that huge leap of 8 years of experience because of some of those setbacks that we had, and we had to learn. We learned the hard way, but we did learn. So this year we're winning because we have had those lessons. And of course, thanks to no small part by the increased capabilities that we also have with the additional helicopters and some ISR capabilities that were given to our security forces. We relied heavily on the international forces from medevac to, like I said, intelligence and ISR capabilities. That was,
Thanks, thanks, Ambassador. Before moving beyond security, May the 23rd, there was a very important event that happened, and that's when the U.S. struck with a drone and was able to kill the leader of the Taliban, Mullah Mansour. What does this mean to you, Ambassador? What does it mean to Afghanistan? It seems to me there's a lot of dimensions to this. First of all, it's hard to speculate right now. Does it mean anything in terms of weakening Taliban's command and control and their unity of effort? Does it provide opportunities to the government of Afghanistan? And then we also have to state that that strike did not occur in Afghanistan. That strike occurred in Pakistan. And it's still a difficult issue. Osama bin Laden, when he was killed, was not killed in Afghanistan. He was killed in Pakistan. Now the leader of the Taliban, not killed in Afghanistan, killed in Pakistan. So to the extent that you can talk about that, we'd appreciate your views.
Well, it was an important event, and we were grateful that President Obama made such a bold decision on taking that action, because it proved to the Afghans and to the international community what the Afghans had been saying for a long time, that the safe havens in the Taliban leadership was on the other side of the border in Pakistan. This gave a boost of confidence to the Afghans, and it gives us hope in the sense that there is action taken and that the international community would continue to put more pressure on Pakistan to take action against, and that this is not something they can get away with. So from an Afghan perspective, I think Afghanistan's perspective, watching the situation closely as the Taliban have elected selected a new president. A new emir or a new leader for that matter, and would want to see what his actions would be. We, of course, our doors for peace are open. That's been our government's consistent policy. Anyone who would like to talk and to negotiate peace, our government's doors are always open. But we would see as the situation develop whether there is any mood for that.
Thank you. If we could talk now a bit Afghanistan's foreign policy, and in particular, starting with neighbor Pakistan. I mentioned Osama bin Laden's death, and I recall that the day after this successful raid that our chief of station and I went to brief President Karzai on what had transpired. He was already aware, had been told by Washington, D.C. in advance, but as we discussed with President Karzai the raid, President Karzai, as we got to the point that said, and then we launched our helicopters with our strike force out of Jalalabad, he said, "Ambassador, where's Jalalabad?" And I said, "Well, I think you know, Mr. President, it's in Afghanistan." He said, "Yes." And he said, "Then I'll continue." And we said, "The raid took place in Abbottabad." And he said, "Where's Abbottabad?" And I said, "Well, I think you know, Mr. President, that's in Pakistan." And he said, "Yes, my point that I've been making to you for many years now." So I know this has been a challenge for Afghanistan's foreign policy, that you are trying to find a way, and President Ghani, I know, has been trying to find a way to improve your relations with Pakistan. But we've got to be clear, in certain ways, your strategic interests to the two countries are just, they're not aligned. Can you talk to us at all about your thoughts on Afghan-Pakistan relations? What are at stake here, the history, and what are the possibilities? President Ghani, he's made some bold efforts to try to improve that relationship.
Absolutely. The president made it very clear right from the beginning of his presidency to reach out to Pakistan and make sincere efforts to make what he termed undeclared hostility towards Afghanistan, to end that and mend relationship to eventually move to a more normalized relationship with Pakistan. This was in part done because if we don't do this, we'd never be able to reach the peace that we want to in Afghanistan, because those sanctuaries that you mentioned were on Pakistani territory. And it would just be a matter of simply changing one group to another. We could reconcile with some groups, but those groups are not going to be, if there is no change in Pakistani policy. So those efforts would continue. I think we're hoping that the international community would also put additional pressure. I think the quadrilateral group is quite important in making those gains happen to create a better understanding. And we encourage Pakistan to play a more positive role in Afghanistan, to play a more constructive role in Afghanistan.
Do you see China as being able to provide Afghanistan with additional assistance in the years ahead? After 9/11 and the U.S. and the international intervention into Afghanistan, at that time, China was not a major donor in Afghanistan. But that was in 2002, and China's, with its growth rates that it's been able to maintain even since then, has become a much more powerful country. And it does seem like China has increasing concerns with terrorism in Central and South Asia. They have a special relationship with Pakistan. What do you see as China's role in Afghanistan's future?
Well, all our neighbors, and especially with China being such an important economic actor in the region, we've been trying to build a consensus that peace in Afghanistan is not only important for Afghanistan. Instability in Afghanistan could destabilize the region. And those efforts have been successful to a large degree, where the region feels responsible and feels that investing in Afghanistan is in their own strategic interests. Whether that investment is through playing a much larger role in making sure that Afghanistan is stabilized, or in economic investment directly.
You know, at Stanford this afternoon, the ambassador was very generous with his time, and we have a seminar at Stanford, a graduate undergraduate seminar on America's war in Afghanistan. And each week we bring in another guest speaker and a presenter to give a different perspective of the war in Afghanistan. So 1 week somebody from the U.S. military, 1 week somebody from the Central Intelligence Agency, and of course the major stakeholder, Afghanistan, today. You said, Ambassador, something very interesting to the to our seminar, that as many years as I've been in Afghanistan, I had not really thought more carefully about. That is that Afghanistan, with this very difficult history that you've had beginning in the 1970s with Soviet occupation, with civil war, with Taliban, and then a diaspora that gets spread around the world, coming back into Afghanistan, people with experience in Europe, the United States, some here. People that had experience in as refugees in Iran, Pakistan. This question of how does Afghanistan now, in this century, constitute a new identity, where you have all of these different perspectives and all of these different histories. Can you talk to us about that challenge?
Well, I think you put it, described that problem very well. We had different times when people left Afghanistan with a different memory of what Afghanistan looked like and where they lived. Perhaps people who left under the King Zahir Shah period, if they left Kabul, they remember Afghanistan very differently and think of it as the Afghanistan to them was defined as their lives in Kabul, not necessarily all of Afghanistan, and what the lives of the Afghans in the rural areas would have been. And then at every event, at every major revolution, many people left the country, and they went to, like you said, different places. They became refugees in Pakistan, in Iran. Some went to the West and came to the United States and Europe. And when the opportunity presented itself after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, the people who returned back all had different versions of visions for what they wanted Afghanistan, or how they saw the future of Afghanistan. Now, that has not been studied more anthropologically. I think there are only a few places in Afghanistan where universities would allow their researchers to go and study the culture. I must say that some things like the Asia Foundation survey of the Afghan people, those play a key bridging role in making a sense of what the people think and what is it that Afghans today want. But it would require more comprehensive understanding of what the needs of Afghans are and what they actually think. So when people talk about Afghanistan, they talk about the divisions or all the that existed at some point and they were maybe studied or understood or written about. Things have changed. What is that new change? That's not very deeply understood. And I think as we work together, what the current situation shows that despite the differences where in one family you would perhaps have three different cultures. Someone who stayed in Afghanistan throughout this period and went through difficulties of their own. Others who became refugees in the different countries, perhaps maybe one of the neighboring countries and came back, had their own experience and their own ways of how they think of the future or rebuilding Afghanistan, and those perhaps who came from the West. And we all work together to form the future. I think this shows, to start with, is the Afghan resilience and our level of tolerance for different views, and at the same time presents itself into a challenge of having a better understanding of what the situation is today and to better understand our problems and so that we can formulate better solutions for our future.
Thank you, Ambassador. I'll ask one last question, then we're going to open it up to the audience here. If we go back to 2001, 2002, it seemed the Taliban had been vanquished very quickly, and there was confidence that now it would be an era of peace. And by 2004, 2005, there were signs that that was not going to be the case. So we're now at the year 2016. We're almost 15 years after the fall of the Taliban, fighting still going on. Any good diplomat, any good soldier would say that peace will not come when the last enemy has been killed. Peace will come when a peace agreement is reached, which gets to the question of reconciliation. Who is it that the government of Afghanistan is fighting right now? This Taliban, I don't think it's the same group it was in 2001. It's evolved over time. Why has it been so difficult for the government, with the support of the international community, the Americans, to try to get the Taliban and their leaders to come to the table and negotiate a peace settlement?
I think with the way we look at it is not just a reconciliation process. We look at it as to bring peace to a country. There has to be several different aspects that to take into consideration. That includes economic development. It's a very young country in terms of demographic. About 75% of our population is under the age of 35, and they need jobs. They need to be able to rely on have an economy and be able to feed themselves and their families. There is also the aspect of the government to be able to deliver its services to its people. So that's where the government gets its legitimacy from. It's also a factor of reconciling, but reconciling with whom? Your question is pretty right. There are people who may have grievances with the Afghan government. And if their grievances are political, they can be addressed. But then there are people who do not want anything from Afghanistan. They're just plain terrorists. What do we do with the terrorists who are coming from Chechnya, from ATIM, the Uzbeks, the Pakistanis, the Arabs, who are fighting in Afghanistan? There is no precedence of reconciling with international terrorists in the country, and they don't actually want anything from the Afghan government. Their goal is to terrorize, and that their objectives are far outside of the country. They're not limited to just the Afghan geography, and those we have to fight. Then there are also criminals. You know, when any war continues for such a long time, many people become invested in it. Now, the question here is how much of the insurgency is being fueled by the drug trade, and vice versa, and how much of the drug trade fueling the insurgency, and how many criminals are involved in this? Who are we? There is a need for separating, I think, the different groups. There is a need for those who have grievances and want to resolve them through a peace negotiation. That, to them, the Afghan government has always have open doors, and we will continue to make efforts to reconcile those who are Afghans and want to be part of the Afghan society and be normalizing in any grievances that would need to be resolved. But then to separate them from the criminals who are purely doing this for financial gain or other interests would need to be dealt with as criminals. And then the international terrorists who do not want peace would have to be dealt with militarily. Any stability or peace in Afghanistan would have to take several different aspects into account, and we need to build a strong state, which is what we are doing, a self-reliant Afghanistan that has a strong military that can defend its soil from threats and have an economy that can stand on its own two feet and a government that can provide services to its people effectively. And that's when we'll be able to build what we hope to achieve, a self-reliant and peaceful and prosperous Afghanistan.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Ambassador Hamdullah Mahib, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. He's in conversation with Carl Eikenberry, who's the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and is now at Stanford University. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
Let me turn now to questions that have come from the audience here. And the first is on equality for women. An American soldier might, on a particularly bad day in Afghanistan, say, I wasn't sent to Afghanistan to have women go to school. Is this important? Is it important for the United States that we continue to invest, as our country has done, in women's rights program and trying to elevate the status of women in Afghanistan? I know the Asia Foundation has had major programs in that regard. With achievements and success of these programs, how does it help the country of Afghanistan? What does it mean to the United States?
Well, as a government, we feel that we will not be able to achieve our objectives if half of our population is not participating in it. So it's important that women play an active role in the Afghan society and that they are empowered enough to do that. We started a women's economic empowerment program in Afghanistan as recently. And that's the effort to make sure that women have more access. But at the same time, they're more involved in government. In the past 18 months, more women have been put. We have four ministers. Those are at the leadership level. We have more deputy governors and ambassadors to create the role models that are required for women and to take that lead so they're active participants in the society. There are over 262 female judges alone in Afghanistan, and I think many people don't know how big a role the Afghan women play in Afghanistan. It's not just at the parliament level or all the human rights activists or rights activists. They are actually part of the society, and they play an active role in that society. And we wanted to be able to make it a lot easier for them to do that. So the government recently made legal framework for them to be able to do so, anti-harassment laws at work, and also, like I said, the Women Economic Empowerment Plan to be able to give them more resources to be able to achieve that goal as we want to. And I think the best thing that gives me hope is it's not just the women or the international community that's involved. It's not like the United States wanting Afghan women rights or the women in Afghanistan only wanting that. Today, the Afghan society desires it. It's not just, it transcends gender now. There was a horrific incident where a young woman was murdered on the streets. And it was tragic, but what we saw out of that was inspiring. The men took to the streets demanding justice for her. And we've seen that trend continue. And that is what gives us hope that I think we're moving towards a more just and equal society for ourselves, for Afghanistan, and that we would be able to build and utilize all of the resources that we have, both men and women, to be able to build the self-reliant Afghanistan that we wish to do.
Thanks, Ambassador. Another question about the enormous mineral wealth that is found in Afghanistan, but it's there, and estimates from the U.S. Geological Survey was perhaps $3 trillion of wealth of all kinds, with very high-grade iron ore, some of the best copper found in the entire world in Afghanistan, lithium, marble, possible energy sources in the north, you name it. It's there in the Hindu Kush and the areas around it. But the problem is that it's there in the mountains, and there's a lot of insecurity around those mountains, and there's not good road networks getting there, not sources of energy that are needed even to extract, don't have the commercial laws in place to encourage investment, but still, it looks awfully promising. What's Afghanistan doing right now with an eye on the longer term to put in place what's needed in order to try to extract that mineral wealth? What help do you need from the international community to do so?
Simple investment. What our government is doing is making sure that the that our mineral wealth or that wealth, we don't get into what some of the African countries perhaps did, whether they went into a resource curse problem, to put the laws and procedures in place that would both protect the investors, but also to make sure the revenues generated is fed to the Afghan people and it reaches where it's needed. But of course, we're also making sure that there is investments in infrastructure that would be able to make this a viable business for any investor to come in. So some of the mines who are perhaps closer to one another could join venture to be able to build the infrastructure, because it would then make all of them affordable. If it was just for one specific mine, the infrastructure alone may not be able to gain the profits. But the government is putting its effort into building that infrastructure, but also create a legal framework to protect these investments. And that by itself has been a huge undertaking. So when we talk to investors, including American investors who had invested in Afghanistan and left, their biggest concern was not insecurity. Their biggest concern was they didn't feel that the legal framework existed to protect their investments in Afghanistan. In the past 18 months alone, the government has passed or is working on passing at least 60 laws. Every cabinet meeting has at least one of these legal framework, whether it's a law or a procedure that is brought to the cabinet to be able to pass or discuss. That is to create the framework for us to be able to bring the investment and also make sure that if people need access to international arbitration courts or others, that those possibilities exist. But in addition to that, to reform the Afghan institutions, including our own judiciary and the Attorney General's office, which has begun, happy to report that we have, in the past few months, changed or replaced at least 400 judicial officials. That included 152 judges. And we didn't just recycle. We brought in new non-corrupt specialists to take up these new positions. Also, the Attorney General's office has been working on their own reforms, where the heads of the provincial offices, prosecutors, were replaced. And these were people who were known to be corrupt, and making it harder for people, not just the ordinary Afghans, but also the investors, to get about their business. What we're working to make sure that we increase our ratings in the business, doing business indicators in Afghanistan.
In order for Afghanistan to get whatever is inside of that country, whether it's agricultural produce or whether it's handicraft or whether it's mineral resources to market, it needs access at some point to seaports. What is Afghanistan President Ghani doing today to achieve that goal?
Well, we're diversifying our markets. you may have heard, we just had a trilateral agreement with Iran and India on the Chabahar port, so that gives us one alternative route.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. It would give us an alternative route, which is shorter to the sea from the port to our borders. And at the same time, it moves that dependency where we have on Karachi, the port alone. But also to create a land bridge through Central Asia to Europe. There are discussions and progress on how we can perhaps use Central Asian route to reach European markets. You may be aware that we just recently joined World Trade Organization, WTO, and that makes it easier if we have problem with transit. You know, again, gives us access. Our traders have access to international quotes to resolve their conflicts. But we're also working closely with our neighbor, Pakistan, to see if we can make it mutually beneficial for us to have access to, for example, Afghanistan wants access to India, more direct access land route, which would be much cheaper than a seaport route. If we have that for, they will also be able to use Afghanistan as a route for them transit to Central Asia so they can reach their own market.
Shifting, a great question here on President Ghani and his pledge to try to root out corruption. Can you talk about President Ghani's plans and his programs that he has ongoing and the challenges that you're facing here?
Well, President Ghani ran on a platform of reforms, and he has been making sure that he comes true on his word. Several different actions were taken and continue to. It's not a problem that we would be able to root out in a year or two. It's a consistent effort, but the efforts at different levels have already started and they are already paying off. Things like I mentioned the reforms of in judiciary, for example, replacing corrupt officials at the Attorney General's office, at Customs. Last year, despite the decline in spending, our revenue went up by 22%. With all that decline in the military spending, it was surprising to many in how we were able to do that. It was only because we managed to collect more revenue by reforming the customs in on borders. Efforts like that already has paid off, and there is more in the process. But I think it would also mention that we are trying to root out corruption by taking out what was giving people a reason to do it. For example, all our ministries were busy procuring. The president made a central procurement commission that goes through and evaluates all the contracts, and he himself and the CEO plus key ministers sit on that council to evaluate all the important contracts. It has done two things. One, so far, it has saved over $400 million. And to put that in contrast, last year, we received in aid support from the United States as part of the New Development Partnership, $180 million. And we saved $400 million. Now, that $400 million saved could be rerouted to spend on key government priorities, rather than being wasted. It's also important to our international donors that we are making sure that their taxpayers' money is spent well, you know, spent right. It's also important, the second component of that is that now ministries are focused on their core functions. And again, to give you an example, the Ministry of Education, for example, was busy constructing schools, not building schools, construction, in the construction business of itself, and printing books. Now, they've printed over 30 million books, but what is inside the book? No one paid attention to what was being, or at least not enough attention to make sure that all the text inside it is correct, because there was no money in that. There was money in printing books. There was money in constructing schools, not building it. Now the Ministry of Education is totally focused on making sure that the text in the books that is being printed, the curriculum, they're paying attention to that, not to the construction that has been centralized to one part, which is one ministry that is responsible for that construction. And they're focusing more on making sure that the schools have their teachers, you know, and that they have the right trainings to be better educators. So it takes away the root where the corruption was. It takes that completely away from them first. So we blocked it there, and then worked with the institutions to stop all the other sources of corruption where people use their authority or their positions to make money for themselves, but to also make it difficult for citizens to receive the government services. And the other aspect that you mentioned, nepotism, for example, it was a big problem and continues to be at some levels. But if we are to build, you know, an Afghanistan that would be able to sustain itself, we have got to be able to build systems that prevent that from happening. And this is a key question. That's why reforms are so important to us, and that's why we're putting so much effort into reforming the government, not just at the at contracting level, but also at the human resources bit, to make sure we, at least the new people that come in, are not coming through into the government through nepotistic channels. In the military alone, we can, just to come back to that, we replaced the president, replaced 150 generals. They were all retired. And in the process, while replacing them, made sure that these were not people that were again recommended by a certain groups, but people who were actually qualified and deserved to be promoted to those positions.
Thanks, Ambassador. I'm going to ask if you're a Afghan American, if you'd raise your hand. Well, we know that this question came from one of several people. it's a great question. As an Afghan American, what can I do to help Afghanistan?
I get asked this a lot. Afghan Americans believe that they would have to return to Afghanistan. Of course, we need the skills, we need the qualification, and we need you to come back and start businesses, you know, use your skills to provide jobs, invest in Afghanistan. All of those are important. But if you can't do that, if you cannot come back and make investment in Afghanistan, what you could do from here, from being involved in the American way of life, you make a huge impact. By interacting with other Americans, you represent Afghanistan and what it is for. Sadly, the majority of the Americans receive their news on Afghanistan, and they're usually negative news because that's what is being reported. So they have an abstract picture of what Afghanistan and the Afghan people are like. Meeting you and talking to you and being active, they get a sense of it becomes real to them. So, well, I may be the official ambassador, you are all ambassadors here of your country. But also to participate in the U.S. and American systems administration, I encourage young Afghan Americans to run for any kind of administration, whether even if it's a school board, to be involved, because your voices here could help your country back home. I mean, your voices are extremely important. This is a democratic country, and your senators, your representatives have to listen to you. And you know, other communities have played a very important role for their own countries. I think Afghan Americans can do that, and so can, let me expand on that, so can the Friends of Afghanistan. I think Afghanistan is probably one of the luckiest countries, and I probably am one of the luckiest ambassadors, because I feel we have so many friends here. Americans who served in Afghanistan, if they didn't leave a part of themselves in their country, they brought a part of us with them, you know, and they really feel, everyone I meet, and the numbers are quite large, who want us to succeed as much as we want us to succeed. You know, there are over a million Americans who served in Afghanistan in a military capacity. There are over 60,000 that served in civilian roles. And all of those friends of Afghanistan can play an important role to make sure that the gains made in Afghanistan are sustained, are maintained, and we don't go back on it. We owe it to your sacrifices and to the sacrifices of our own, to make sure that we build on the gains and honor those sacrifices by making Afghanistan a success.
I wanted to take an opportunity here, Ambassador, to express my deep gratitude to you and on behalf of all Americans to you. On the ride from Stanford, coming north to San Francisco on 280, we passed by the San Bruno Golden Gate National Cemetery, and I pointed that out to the ambassador and said we have veterans of the Afghan War who are buried there. And the ambassador looked over and said, I didn't know there was a national cemetery here. What he went on to say is that he routinely around our country, when he knows of national cemeteries close to military bases, he goes there to pay the respect of the Afghan people to our fallen who have served in Afghanistan. And I was extraordinarily moved to hear you say that's how you you feel it's important to spend your time. In fact, I'd like to give you a round of applause for that.
I have to say here, the Afghan people are very grateful. I know that it might not be perceived that way, but the Afghan people are very grateful for the service that Americans have done and the work that you all did in our country. We wouldn't be where we are without that support, without those sacrifices. And we want to make sure that those are not underestimated. Today, we have institutions in place, and if our government managed to pass that test, like I said in the beginning, during that, these institutions were built with your support. And it shows that work paid off. Today, we have over 135 universities in our country, both private and public. Over 8 million children go to school, 40% of them girls. We have hospitals that perform heart surgeries today, whereas even a few years ago, people had to go abroad to even treat malaria, simple diseases like that. To us, the progress we have made is relative. It's not, of course, it's not where we would want it, and it's not where perhaps our international partners would want Afghanistan to be. But we're on the right path on building. Development takes much longer than one would wish it to. And some of this development is not easy to report either, so I'm not blaming people for not having reported it, because I think it's difficult to consume the kind of information and to tell a story of development than if you were to report perhaps a terrible suicide attack because you or a destruction of a bridge or something, because that itself can be reported in a headline alone. But if you were to talk about the American University of Afghanistan and having had its first graduation, having worked there myself, when I read that headline, it was perhaps very different to what everyone else's assumption or read of it would have been. To an average reader, the American University graduated its first class. Okay, news done. I worked there. I know how difficult it was to find, first of all, the brave professors to come and teach there, and then to be able to stay in Afghanistan with all the difficulties. Security aside, we didn't have the internet connections for them to be able to talk to their families. They perhaps didn't have access to the kind of food and other facilities that they were used to. It was not an easy environment to work in and to build an institution at that level. That first graduation meant something completely different to me, having had experience how difficult it was to get there, than to an average reader who would probably had no emotional or personal connection to it. But the same goes for when you read in paper to say a hospital in Afghanistan separated conjoined twins. Now, it doesn't explain what that hospital went through in the period of to get to that situation, to be able to have the qualification of the doctors to be able to perform such a sophisticated operation, the logistics for it to be done, the hospital, the infrastructure required to do that. And this progress was built and was made over this period with the support of the United States, with the support of our other international partners. And we're grateful for it. We're grateful for every bit of it. And like I said, we're committed to make sure that we not only preserve that, but build on it. And we are in a great position to build on it. Our government institutions are also in a position. In this political transition, just to loop back to where we were talking about the political transition, not only did the military withdraw, not only did our economy get a hit, we formed a government of national unity. Now, governments of national unity in even developed democracies don't work very well, you know. In a country like Afghanistan, which had no precedence of it, and people were not used to it, we made a government of national unity work. And the what you call the perfect storm, and the perfect storm to have, you know, shared power. In my previous role, I had to deal with some of the frustrations where people didn't know how to react. Even while we're going through, you know, we were talking about institutions trying to, or people working in the government trying to realign their loyalties to the presidency. They now have another position, a chief executive, that they didn't know what to make of, you know, how to handle themselves around it. And the government survived. It's a testament to all the great effort that went into Afghanistan. So I think that's where what I mean by saying we owe it to the sacrifices and the hard work of the American people and our, Afghans. We were, you know, a great partnership, and I think going forward we will continue on that great partnership and building it and strengthening it even further.
Well, I think we've got time for one more question. And Ambassador, I was hoping to avoid this, but we're at a point in the United States politics right now where no ambassador can be in front of an American audience without being asked this question. And you probably know what the question is. I'm not asking it. It's on a card here. And that is, Ambassador, what would do you think at this early point right now, still early in June, with an election in November, but what do you think would be the impact of a President Trump for Afghanistan and U.S. relations? And I can extend that to if you want to talk about the Democratic candidates as well. And one answer that you can't give is that you'll provide advice to whoever wins on how to form a national unity government.
Yeah, no.
Or I can make that easier. Just there is truly, there's uncertainty in our politics right now. Do the Afghan people, are they concerned about that uncertainty themselves?
We believe, and we have Afghanistan and the United States have a strategic partnership agreement, and any decisions made would be in that, and that's what we're pursuing within the context of the strategic partnership agreement. In the time I have been here, I have been talking to people on the Hill on both sides of the aisle, and I think there is. There is support for Afghanistan, and there is bipartisan support for Afghanistan in Congress, and it gives us. That's what we're counting on the to be able to continue that policy and continue to work with the with both parties. I think we're monitoring the elections very closely. We have not made any contact with either candidates. We will watch it until the primaries, and then once the conventions decide that they're confirmed, the nominees are confirmed, we will start making our contact. But if it was required, if situation warranted, we would make that contact earlier. But for now, we're watching the elections very closely.
Well put, Ambassador, and diplomatically safely put.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization. Visit us at worldaffairs.org to take part in the next conversation. This program featured Ambassador Hamdullah Mohib. He's the ambassador from the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. He was in conversation with Carl Eikenberry, former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producers Circle. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.